Neil deGrasse Tyson, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. This time, that final frontier is Cosmos, a space-time odyssey, the awe-inspiring television series hosted by Dr. Tyson. We get a behind-the-scenes look, and we'll talk to Neil about where he'll go after he completes this tour of life, the universe, and everything. Bill Nye and Bruce Betts are also here. Got a great prize for the winner of the new Space Trivia Contest, and you can't go wrong if you begin with senior editor Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, I'm looking back to an April 30 blog entry that you did. Let me start with this question. Who is the Kuiper Belt big shot, Pluto or Eris?
We don't actually know yet, and I kind of hope that this answer gets solved, or this question gets solved, by discovering something that's bigger than both of them out there. But in the meantime, we have a tie for the largest thing in the Kuiper Belt. We don't know whether Pluto or Eris is bigger. We do know that Eris is more massive. But when school kids ask, you know, which thing is the biggest in the solar system, or rank things in order, they don't care about how many kilograms something is. They care about diameter. And within the error that we can measure them at, we do not know which is bigger, Pluto or Eris.
Why is this such a complicated thing to figure out? I mean, you even talked to Alan Stern of the New Horizons mission about this.
Yes, well, it's complicated for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that these things are very far away, so you can't directly image them to measure their size. They're generally not more than one pixel across a detector in your image. So the only way to measure their size is to watch them cross in front of a background star and use what you know about its orbit to calculate from how long the star winked out just how big a thing was that crossed in front of the star. And that's called an occultation. And that's how we get accurate diameters for these very distant, very small objects. So that worked great for Eris, and we figured out that it was somewhere between 2,324 and 2,348 kilometers wide, which is pretty big. The problem with Pluto is that Pluto has an atmosphere. It refracts the starlight. It may block the starlight before the star gets all the way down to sample Pluto's surface. So we just don't know how big Pluto is. It's somewhere between 2,300 and 2,400 kilometers across, but we don't know what the number is yet.
Will New Horizons maybe provide the conclusive answer?
Probably. So New Horizons will, without a doubt, give us a better estimate of Pluto's size. We'll get a much more accurate number. So if Pluto is either substantially bigger or substantially smaller than Eris, then we'll figure that out pretty much right away after the flyby. But if they are pathologically close to each other in size, it's possible that we'll measure Pluto's diameter to be some number that's within this error that we have on Eris's diameter, and we still won't know which one is bigger, which is kind of fun, actually. Kind of a fun problem to have. It's one of the things that makes solar system exploration both so frustrating and so fun.
Pathologically. I love that description for this challenge. And maybe we'll know more in a little bit more than a year when that flyby takes place. It is an April 30 entry. You can even see the little video here of Eris, indeed, occulting a star. It's pretty cool. And I love this illustration. Who did this?
That was Alex Parker, who is the go-to person for me for all things fun and wonderful and illustrating Kuiper Belt objects.
Well, it's at planetary.org in the usual place. She is the senior editor for the Planetary Society and our planetary evangelist, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Emily, I'll talk to you again next week.
See you then, Matt.
Up next, as usual, Bill Nye, the science guy. Bill, the fight for planetary science funding continues in Washington. I guess you're going to have a busy week this week.
Yes, we're going to visit with Senator Dianne Feinstein, and we're going to visit with Charlie Bolden. Call me Charlie, the head of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the administrator of NASA. We're going to meet with him. And here's the big idea, Matt. You know, we got this space launch system. Everybody loves it. Who doesn't? No, it's a big rocket that's being built to launch first in 2017. It was going to launch a second time in 2021. These are years in the future, Matt. And so what we're going to propose to him is that he's used that rocket for deep space missions to the outer planets. My idea, personally, between you and me, wait, the radio audience, is that we'll build more of them and actually speed up the pace and use them to do the missions that everybody's, if I may, arms akimbo about. That is to say, missions to Enceladus, to Europa, the moon of Jupiter, the moon of Saturn, in the other order, out to Uranus and Neptune. These extraordinary way out there destinations. And I'll bet you enthusiasm for these missions goes way up next summer when New Horizons flies by Pluto.
I bet it will too. And of course, decisions like this about how to use a huge new rocket, there's no political angle to this at all in Washington.
Oh, no, no, not at all, Matt. No, no, nobody in any congressional district has any interest at all in building a huge rocket in his or her district. No, no, no. Right, it's all world good.
Wouldn't this be, I would think, attractive to those aforementioned congresspeople who are responding, their districts?
Brilliant. Attractive, it's exactly what they want. Everyone's going to go crazy. It's going to be brilliant. That's one of the things we're going to talk about. And we'll talk about the asteroid redirect mission and the details of that. The premise of that right now is asteroid redirect will be used as part of the roadmap to Mars, which is kind of a redirection of the redirect mission, but it's perhaps all to the good. We'll take a meeting, as we say.
Would you please, as we wrap up, take 15 seconds to say hello or say something nice about your friend, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who we're going to be hearing from in just a moment on this show.
I have not seen Neil since yesterday. We hung out. It was real nice. We had a nice talk. We talked about space policy and these rockets and stuff. Neil is doing a great job with Cosmos, man. He's out there. It's real. I got to say, anecdotally, Matt, it's generational. People who had never been exposed to Cosmos and Carl Sagan before are all talking about it. That's the goal, yes? Get a new generation of people excited about our place in space, about the cosmos.
I couldn't agree more. Bill, I'll let you go. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. Yes, indeed. Neil deGrasse Tyson in just a moment. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist, author, former host of Nova Science Now, current host of Star Talk Radio, a Daily Show regular, and the face and voice of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, the magnificent series airing on Fox, the Nat Geo Channel, and elsewhere around the world. And that is already more introduction than he needs. Neil Tyson, I am so happy to get you back on Planetary Radio.
Thanks. How come I'm not on more often? You don't call? You don't text me. I'm there waiting for you.
You want to be on every week? It's okay with me. I think the boss will say it's okay. By the way, the boss, your buddy, the science guy, he says hello. And
okay.
I asked him if he had any questions.
He's the CEO, yes.
He is. He is the boss, as you were once
Bill Nye, the CEO.
and TSG, the science guy. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this. May I just say what I have already told you in email? I love Cosmos. I think it is gorgeous. I think they are using you to the absolute best of your magnificent ability. And I can't wait to watch the rest of the show.
Well, thank you. As you know, it's a huge collaboration. Andrian and Steve Soter were two of the original three writers of the original 1980 series, and they reprised that effort in this series. So you all see me, you know, as host, and when I'm hosting on location, I see the 100 people who are making the product. so it's very different depending on which direction you're looking in. And I, as an academic, I don't think of myself as a TV person, so much of what it took to make Cosmos was novel to me. For example, now I know what a gaffer does.
As opposed to a key grip, right?
A key grip, yeah. There's the grip and then the key grip. See, to recognize the level of collaboration necessary to pull off a project that large with the visual effects and also, unlike when it first aired on PBS, this is on commercial television, so they're commercials, right? And so you have to actually write to the commercials breaks.
Uh-huh.
It turned out I was delightfully surprised because I was thinking, well, that would really cramp the writing style. And with some help from Brannon Braga, who's known to Star Trek fans as a recurring director and writer of Star Trek Next Generation, has a huge following, and he's been director and writer of many other projects on film and television, he was able to guide us on how to think about the storytelling between commercial breaks. So it allowed what would otherwise be a one-run-long story to be chapterized in the hour that you're watching the program. And that actually has value in the parceling of how you tell the story. So that is the silver lining of the dreaded commercial break.
I suspected that Brandon Braga had a lot to do with that, since he knows how to build things and make people stick around during the commercial break. I want to mention to you one of my favorite sequences, and my wife feels the same way. It's a ways back. It was part of the Was it Hiding in the Light? The whole sequence about this fellow, Joseph von Fraunhofer, which was it was just a gem.
Where that mostly comes from, you know, I have astrophysics fluency being an astrophysicist, and I have partial fluency of the history of science. The person who has the complete fluency in the history of science and the stories we're telling is Steve Soter. Of course, I knew some rudimentary details about Joseph Fraunhofer, and Steve digs up the rest and compares it with notes that Anne has, and they come together and they tell the story. And so in a way, I think of these characters that are portrayed in each of these episodes, I think of them, in some cases, a literal martyr, as in the story of Giordano Bruno, scientific martyr, a philosophical martyr, but also people who have struggled in ways that probably most of us would have never survived. Yet they nonetheless rose up to become the great intellects and contributors to our understanding of science that they were. And Fraunhofer is one of the leaders of the pack. But there's still more episodes to come. He's your favorite at the moment.
No, he's not even my favorite personality that you've presented. But it's just so well told. And what really got to me is, I mean, here's the guy who is, as you explained in the show, laid the basis for spectroscopic analysis, the roots of your profession, astrophysics. But he was also this severely disadvantaged kid who got a leg up basically from his government, the king. And look what came of it.
Yeah, and when I hear stories like that, I lose sleep at night wondering what genius lay undiscovered in the depth of the night because they're hungry or because their access to opportunity and education is not forthcoming. How different the world would be if everyone had access. It's a beautiful story reminding you of how tragic it is when you reflect on how many people didn't have such opportunities.
There is a sequence set to Gershwin where we get to see that city of cities, the Big Apple.
That was the scene that I'm referring to when you see the lower Manhattan skyline. That's correct.
Yeah, across the entire spectrum, which is, so yes. We're back to, the spectrum does seem to be coming up frequently in this series.
Well, it's the only way we know anything about the world. So many people, too many people, and astronomers are partly to blame for this, think that what we do is look at pretty pictures of the universe and deduce the nature of reality. People are thinking that all we want and can't wait for is the next beautiful Hubble photo to advance our science, and that's not how it works. We're getting spectra, we're analyzing light, and there's information hidden in the light. And it's one of my educational points that I try to make when people want to understand how to astrophysicists know what we're talking about as we look around the universe. Yeah, and that's a big challenge because spectra is not a trivial topic to convey. It taxed the visualizers, it taxed the storytelling, but I think we succeeded, or at least certainly whetted a person's appetite for wondering further about what spectra are and how they work.
Well, I'm highly prejudiced, of course, but I think one of the most successful illustrations of this was maybe also one of the simplest, and it's in As We Speak, the episode that is most recently aired about stars. There is the animated sequence with these women who were pioneers whose names are far from being well known, and there is a scene where one of them holds up an image of the spectra of different stars and matches it to the actual star field. And that's a real aha moment.
So now you know that that star made that spectrum.
Neil deGrasse Tyson of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. More in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from Planet Fest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from? And are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do. And together, we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Your name carried to an asteroid. How cool is that? You, your family, your friends, your cat, we're inviting everyone to travel along on NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission to asteroid Bennu. All the details are at planetary.org/BENNU. You can submit your name and then print your beautiful certificate. That's planetary.org/Bennu. Planetary Society members, your name is already on the list. The Planetary Society. We're your place in space.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, back with Neil deGrasse Tyson. We could have spent hours talking about nothing but Cosmos, a space-time odyssey, the television series Neil created with Andrew Ian, Seth MacFarlane, Brannon Braga, and many others. When we spoke a few days ago, there were only a few more weeks of new episodes left to go. By the way, my complete, nearly twice as long conversation with Neil is at planetary.org/radio. It even has a lightning round. There's just one other thing I'll mention about the show, and that is to please congratulate and thank the folks who did all that magical CGI work, because it is just gorgeous. And I think, what do you call it? The giant calendar of the universe that you stand on.
The cosmic calendar, yeah.
Yeah, that traces the entire history of the universe. It's just...
Exactly, and that's a reprise of the cosmic calendar from the original series, but of course done up in a 21st century visualized sensibilities. That's a pretty potent pedagogical tool for conveying, because we all know what a month is and an hour and a minute and a second. So if I say that history as we've come to think of it on Earth, where you have information about people, places, and things, began 14 seconds ago on the cosmic calendar.
Uh-huh.
And you know what seconds are, right? Relative to a year. We found this to be a potent and illuminating way to convey time.
So for those of you who are hearing this and wondering about the details of these scenes that we're discussing, shame on you, because you haven't seen the series, and it's not too late. You can do so online. There will come a time in a few weeks, I'm sorry to say, when Cosmos will have run its course, this edition of Cosmos. Who knows? Maybe there'll be another one someday.
Time to ask me about that.
Sorry.
It's like the woman just gives birth and say, "You ready to have another kid?"
Yeah, really. Yeah, maybe.
I'm thinking we need some time to sort of recover, and then we can have that conversation.
Well, what other than being an astrophysicist and running the Rose Center, what's going to be keeping you busy as the series ends?
Thanks for asking. There are some writing projects that I fell behind on while we were making the series, and those are, one book is half written, and I have a co-author on that, and two other books. So I want to get back to that. I also want to become a scientist again rather than just play one on TV. So I have some research projects I'm going to get back into with 2 feet, one on the structure of our galaxy and another one on dwarf galaxies that are in the neighborhood of the Milky Way. So those are some longtime loves of mine professionally. Also, I have a radio program, Star Talk Radio, which is kind of the inversion of the science radio program. You know, the ones we're familiar with, typically there's a journalist interviewing a scientist, and those are time tested. But when you tune in, you know what you're tuning in for. You're going to say, "I like science, and I want to hear who they're interviewing this week," and it's going to be a scientist. And Science Friday comes to mind in that example.
Yeah, I can think of another show that's kind of like that. Oh yeah, this one. That's right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'm glad you think the format is still valid, but yours is quite different.
Yeah, so it's different. So I'm the host rather than the journalist, and my guests are hardly ever scientists. It kind of inverts the model, and I just talk about all the ways science impacts the livelihood of the people who are my guest. It gets some fun revelations there. You know, we had Morgan Freeman, for example, as a guest, and these are people hewn from pop culture. So you've heard of them or you know of the work they do. And so you follow them to that radio show, even if you had never listened to science on the radio before or in a podcast. And so that's when you learn that he looked up at the night sky and from his porch in Louisiana when he grew up. And he always wondered what was beyond there. And it became a partial lifelong quest for him. And one of his favorite things he's doing is he's got a TV show on, what is it, on the Science Channel, Through the Wormhole. And it's his way to celebrate this lifelong interest in the universe that he has had. So it's that kind of conversation. We're finding new ways to bring that to the public as well. So that's pretty much what I'll be. I think I'm going to recede a little bit from the public limelight, let others sort of rise up. I think the ground is fertile enough for that to happen. But I'm tired.
I'm very happy to hear that you'll be back doing astrophysics, because there's so much more to learn about the universe.
Doing the research is a fuel source for the energy I have to even bring any of it to the public.
We're going to put up links to Cosmos on TV. I think it's is the website, but
yeah,
to
Cosmos
that,
on TV.
Yeah, to that, to Star Talk as well. Of course, you can just Google these, but we'll put up links on the show page at planetary.org/radio. Thank you, Neil. I look forward to seeing you again on Sunday night, the next episode of Cosmos, Waiting with Bated
Breath. Exactly,
Breath.
And it repeats, as you know, on Monday night on National Geographic Channel, which is responsible for the world distribution of the program. It's in 181 countries, 45
and
languages.
Half a billion homes?
That's what they say, and of course, not everyone is watching at the same instant, but, although we would really love it if that were the case.
Yeah, and there's a cool iPad app, too. So you'll hear about that if you watch the show, as you should. Please don't entirely retire to the hallowed halls of astrophysics. I'm very happy to know and assume that you will continue to be a force out there in the public as well. Because
no, there's people. Okay, I mean, I won't go disappear completely, but I'm going to be directing inquiries to people, media inquiries to colleagues of mine who I know can bear the load.
Thank you, Neil. This has been delightful.
Okay, Matt. Sorry I got on late. I hope it didn't cramp you too much.
Nah, not in the least.
Okay.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is an American astrophysicist, author, and science communicator. Can you tell this is right out of the Wikipedia? He directs the Hayden Planetarium at the Rose Center for Earth and Space. He's also a research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History. And full disclosure, he is a member and past president of the Planetary Society Board, and you can hear him on Star Talk, too, if you want some more laughs. I will be back, hopefully, for a few laughs with the he's got a new title. He's no longer the director of projects. I'll leave it to talk with him about it. It's Bruce Betts for this week's edition of What's Up. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the... Wait a minute. What are you?
People have been asking that for decades.
I know there's a change. Give it to us.
I am now the Planetary Society Director of Science and Technology.
Yay! Hey, that's terrific. There's a big raise, corner office. Do you still have to iron Bill's bow ties?
Yes. But I do it scientifically and technologically rather than just having it be a project.
You don't use that hot rock anymore.
No, we've moved up to irons heated in the fire.
Well, congratulations. And if you're still qualified to do so, in fact, you're probably more qualified. Tell us about the night sky.
Yeah, it's more a title change to reflect where I've always fit in the organization. But we'll see. You can judge whether I'm still qualified. Up in the night sky, you can see rocks. This week in space history, nothing happened. Random space fact. Oh, wait. All right, let me try that again.
Take two.
Don't air this, whatever you do.
Oh, no, I promise.
Oh, thank you. That always makes me feel warm and fuzzy. Speaking not at all of warm and fuzzy, in the evening sky. So there's a cool three-planet thing going on in the evening sky. You've got Jupiter looking super bright over in the west. This is the early evening, so go out 8, 9 o'clock, depending on where you are. Maybe 10. Jupiter will be getting lower, but then on the other side of the sky in the east, you got Mars looking reddish up high, pretty high by that time, and then Saturn down below it in the east. And you can play the game where you connect the dots of the planets and note that they do kind of connect in a roughly straight line, once again proving that the solar system disk of planets is pretty much a disk.
All right, I'm going to keep checking, though.
Oh, and in the pre-dawn, Venus, super bright, low in the east. You keep checking, Matt. You let us know how that works out. We move on to this week in space history. In 1961, the first American flew in space, Alan Shepard, on Freedom 7. And 5 years ago, the launch of the last Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission occurred, STS-125, Atlantis. We move on to... Space fact!
Well, nice job. And it's only now that I remember I have some more celebrity random space fact folks for us. I guess I'll have to try it next week.
Thank you for not squelching my brilliance. So, speaking of Alan Shepard, Freedom 7, Mercury, suborbital flight, first American space, it lasted only 15 minutes and 22 seconds from launch to landing.
Up and back, yeah.
Up and back, but space in between. All right, so we move on to the trivia contest. And I asked you, what is the name of the moon of the trans-Neptunian object Quarwar? Quarwar. And its moon, also with an entertaining name. How'd we do?
A nice response to this. And our winner, first-time entrant, who also is apparently new to the program because she says, I just discovered you guys and so excited to get involved. Well, we're excited too, Tracy, and we're even more excited that Tracy Meyer was chosen by random.org as this week's winner. Tracy says that the answer is Waywat.
Indeed, Quarwar and Waywat.
Waywat. Many other people, including Stephen Coulter, who told us Waywat, named after the Tongva sky god, is the son of Quarwar.
Exactly. It's all in the family.
Now, here's the best response. Oh, by the way, Tracy is going to get a Planetary Radio t-shirt.
Cool.
And a cool prize coming up, so don't go away. Here is the response that entertained me the most from Russ Black. I will read it exactly as sent. What an interesting quarry. Wait, what was the question again? Russ, you almost deserve a shirt for that.
Okay, back to Alan Shepard, Freedom 7, first American in space, suborbital flight. Measured across the Earth's surface, how far did Alan Shepard travel in Freedom 7? So from the launch point to the landing point, not counting the vertical distance going up and down, but as the crow flies as opposed to the spacecraft, how far did Alan Shepard travel in Freedom 7? Go to planetary.org/radio contest, get us your entry. And what are they competing for this week, Matt?
A very cool prize. We have been given by the Little Bits people, littlebits.cc is the website, a Little Bits kit, specifically their new space kit developed in collaboration with NASA. And it is pretty much what it sounds like. It's Little Bits of electronics. These things are so cute. In fact, this is what Fast Company said about them. I'm looking at their website. Life is like a box of adorable electric components. But they're really fun, and they have these cool space-related projects. You can assemble them. It's got, you know, like little light sensors and a microphone and a motor. And anyway, it's fun. We're going to give it away to the winner of this new question that Bruce has just posed. You'll need to get it to us by the 13th. Is it? Yes. May 13, Tuesday the 13th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Very cool prize.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about adorable electronic parts. Thank you and good night.
Should I tell Bruce I broke my promise? He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up.
What?
NASA's newest space spinoffs. That's next time on Planetary Radio, which is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by the totally cosmic members of the Society. Clear skies.
Thank you.